Sometimes I read in the bathtub. And I was reading in the bathtub, and I read this one very short part from Jerry's earlier book. And they had done a draft board raid in Copley Square,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
In Boston. And Jerry had this friend who had a nickname Bug.
Bug.
Yes. And so Jerry was about to, you know, pass the word on, to sort of announce that this action had happened. And I'm going to read this really quick bit. Excuse me. I stopped by a payphone and called Bug, who I had earlier told in a vague way about what was being planned. He was then a student at Harper College in Binghamton, New York. I woke him up in his dorm room. I said, "This is an anonymous caller." I described the draft board action in some detail, but was careful to use the passive voice and the third person. But my voice would have been unmistakable to my old friend. "Do you understand?" I asked at the end of the call. "Yes," Bug replied, "and congratulations." I thought that part was really great because of one day I was sitting in here at this, you know, the store was open. I'm sitting here at the computer. If you've been in here before, when the events aren't happening, these shelves are out. And Jerry came in, and I didn't really see who it was. You know, I couldn't see any face. But I heard Jerry talking way over in that corner, past two or three shelves. And there's this film called Hit and Stay about the Catholic draft board raids, which goes over, like, a lot of these raids. And it's kind of almost a too-long film for some of our short attention spans. But I've seen it so many times. We screened it here. We helped a screening happen down at Market Arcade when it was first premiering. And I teach a class that covers this and have shown the film a dozen times or more in that class. So I've seen this film like over a dozen times. And Jerry's over there, and I hadn't seen him walk in. And just like Bug was going to recognize his voice on that phone call, I immediately recognized the voice of somebody who I had never met in person before. Because I was really taken by his presence in that film, and what he contributed to the film and that movement, and he was one of the people that really stuck out to me. So when he came in, we had a talk, and he's like, you know, one thing led to another. We carried his book, and he's doing this presentation, and so I'm really personally happy that he's here, because this movement of people who are willing to risk a lot and burglarize federal facilities to try to stop an unjust, immoral war, you know, probably had ramifications that impacted all of our lives that we'll never understand, right? Entire swaths of cities were not drafted at certain times because of this, right? And it helped build a movement that was strong enough and willing to take the kind of risks that's necessary to fight off some of these things that are terrible that we need to fight off. So, with that, I just want to welcome Jerry to Burning Books. Thanks a lot.
Thank you very much. And thank all of you for coming. The bookstore chose a absolutely perfect title for my talk tonight. They're billing it as The Untold Story of Draft Resistance. And when I started working on my last book, my latest book, which is here, I was absolutely shocked and amazed at the fact that there has never been a book written in the United States that traces the history of conscription in this country back to the pre-Revolutionary War state militias. And similarly, there was no single book that traced the history of opposition to conscription back to that time. And, you know, there are particular books about conscription in the Civil War and in World War I and World War II. But no book had looked at that whole temporal sweep and was able to sort of draw lessons, connections, differences between eras. And that's what this book does, and that sort of is the title of the talk about the untold story of draft resistance in the country. So let's start in the Civil War. The first federal draft in this country was enacted by the 39th Congress in March of 1863. The Civil War wasn't going as well as the Union hoped. And every scholar up to today who's ever written about the Civil War draft in the North, and there have been a lot of them, Eugene Murdoch, James Geary, Peter Levine, they all say that the draft refusal rate in the Union during the Civil War was 20%. And they all say what an astonishingly, astonishingly high figure that was, because refusing the draft was a capital offense. And people were shot during the Civil War for refusing the draft, sometimes, but not always, after being tortured. All of those scholars drew their astonishing 20% figure from the same source, the same underlying source. And that is, at the end of the Civil War, General James Barnett Fry, who had run conscription in the North during the Civil War, published for the War Department this very, very, very detailed record of conscription. Everybody who had been drafted, broken down by congressional district, how many of those people got out of the draft by paying the $300 commutation fee? You know, you could pay $300 and get out, and in that way, the Civil War draft ensured that rich men never got killed at the front, but only poor men did, and it made more explicit the kind of economic discrimination with conscription that was more implicit in the 20th century. And Fry recorded how many people provided substitutes and how many people got out because they had blind in one eye. How many, it was unbelievably detailed, went on hundreds and hundreds of pages, how many people had a broken fourth toe on the left foot. It was incredible. There was just, and then he came up with the figure that 20% refused the draft. And there was just one eensy-weensy-weensy little problem with what General Fry did, and that is, it was all wrong. And the mistake that he made that no one had picked up was that he started his calculation near the end of the process, after people got draft notices. He didn't start his calculation at the beginning of the process when people were supposed to be enrolled or registered for the draft. The Civil War draft, unlike the Vietnam War draft, perversely put no obligation on men to register. It put the obligation to register people on the government. So they had these enrollment officers who would ride on horseback from town to town to town, signing people up, which of course gave the opportunity for people to not answer the door, for mothers to say there were no sons at home, for people to leave town when the enrollment officer came. They were called skulkers, or to leave town and never come back, they were called skedaddlers. And in fact, what I did that the other historians didn't do is I compared the registration figures to the census figures. It was a bit of a complicated calculation because you had to adjust for age and alienage. But what I found is that nationwide, 30% of the men who were legally obligated to register, be registered, didn't register. And that was over and above the 20% who refused induction when they got induction orders. So what you've got is, you've got over 50%, and in some states, in the book, I break it down by state, in some states it's over 70% of the men who were legally obligated to be drafted refused to be drafted by one means or another. It was illegal. It was a capital offense. Leslie talked about these draft board raids, that, and I do talk about that in my earlier book. During the Vietnam War, I burglarized 14 draft boards in three different cities. Over a period of time, we destroyed records of men eligible to be drafted. We destroyed all the critical portions of the cross-reference system. We destroyed duplicate records in state headquarters. In general, we put those draft boards out of commission for the rest of the Vietnam War. They never drafted again. And those of us who were involved in that thought that we had come up with a unique and effective way to stop the draft. And we were half right. It was effective. Those boards never drafted again. But it was not unique. That stuff happened a lot during the Civil War. Let's take an example. June 18th, 1863, Fulton County, Illinois. The enrollment officer was taken hostage by anti-draft activists after the enrollment, the registration for the entire county had been completed. The protesters destroyed 100% of the draft records. It took a full company of infantry to redo the draft enrollment in Fulton County. And as soon as it was redone, the protesters destroyed the records once again. Fulton County never drafted anyone. Monroe County, Kentucky. So Kentucky was one of the four slave states in the Union. It was very, very hard to enroll Monroe County, Kentucky. In fact, it took 100 infantry officers being called in, but the enrollment, the registration of draft-age men was partially successful. But as soon as it was completed, protesters stole 100% of those draft files and burned them in front of the somewhat chagrined local draft official. Those were never redone. I won't do it, but I could, literally not figuratively, take the rest of my time talking about other incidents like that in the Civil War. Don't worry, I won't. So a lot of people know that about the anti-draft riots in New York City during the Civil War in July of 1863, but I tell you a little piece of that that you may not know. Many draft boards in New York City were burned to the ground during the anti-draft riots in July 1863 with their records destroyed. But it is an exquisite and piquant irony that the very first draft board to be burned to the ground during the riot was actually torched by New York City firefighters. And the reason for that is that in the previous state militia drafts, firefighters were exempt. And when they found out that under the federal government draft, firefighters were not exempt, they were pissed. And they burned down the draft board. It was the ninth congressional district draft board. It was at 677 3rd Avenue. That's between 46th and 47th Street. And while the draft board burned to the ground, a city alderman named Masterson gave a speech to the anti-draft crowd, was wildly cheered. And when the firefighters noticed that the flames were spreading to an adjacent tenement where people lived, the ever dutiful firefighters put out the blaze because that's the job of firefighters. So World War I, how many people here, you don't count, Steve, have heard of the Green Corn Revolution? The Green Corn Rebellion, I'm sorry, Green Corn Rebellion. So when the draft came in World War I in August 1917, this was an anti-draft protest in rural Oklahoma. It was organized by the Interracial Working Class Union. There's an interracial group in Oklahoma in 1917. They had about 500 armed, heavily armed resistors who were going to make the draft impossible. And the way they got their name, Green Corn Rebellion, was these were mostly illiterate sharecroppers. And they were illiterate black and white sharecroppers working together. And their plan was, it was not a very sophisticated plan, but their plan was that they were going to march to the Capitol in Washington, D.C., and march on the Congress, and with their weapons, they were going to make the Congress repeal the draft. And they were going to kill cattle on the way and barbecue it for food, and harvest green corn from the fields and barbecue that to eat, hence the name Green Corn Rebellion. They ran loose for quite a while. They cut telephone and telegraph wires. They dynamited a bridge. It took the combined posses of several counties totaling 1,000 men to put down the Green Corn Rebellion. Again, it's part of the sort of untold history of draft opposition in the United States. Later, after the Vietnam War period, I worked in the peace movement full-time for about 15 years. Then I went to law school. I was, in fact, the only convicted felon in Harvard Law School's graduating class of 1990. So that's my distinction. And I didn't realize all of the First Amendment cases that we learn about free speech that you study in law school were, in fact, World War I draft cases, people publishing anti-draft flyers. For example, Charles T. Schenck was the general secretary of the Socialist Party in Philadelphia. He published an anti-draft flyer. I reproduced the flyer in the book. It has the headline, "Long Live the Constitution of the United States!" exclamation point. And then it prints the text of the 13th Amendment, which bans slavery. And the flyer says, well, if you're against slavery, if you're against involuntary servitude, naturally you will be against conscription, which is involuntary servitude. He was prosecuted under the Espionage Act. He was sentenced to 20 years in prison. This case is not an outlier. 1,900 people were prosecuted in the 18 months that the draft was in effect during World War II. 1,900 people were prosecuted for making anti-draft statements and sent to prison under the Espionage Act. Espionage Act is still on the books today. It has not fallen into desuetude. They prosecuted Dan Ellsberg under the Espionage Act for releasing the Pentagon Papers, Edward Snowden. I'll give an example. I live in Providence. When I destroyed the draft files in Providence at those four local draft boards, I was actually only planning to stay there for 6 weeks to case the buildings and do the burglary, but then I was indicted by the grand jury and they encouraged me to stay for a while. So this is an example from my hometown, adopted hometown of Providence. When the draft came in 1917, John Dunn, Theodore Hiller, and Adolf Yanyar were draft refusers. They refused to be inducted. They were sentenced under selective service law to 2 years in federal prison. In January 13th, 1918, the next morning, there was a people's forum held in Providence. In 1918, I was just a young man then, so my recollection of it is only vague. But there was a speaker at the forum, Joseph Caldwell, and Joseph Caldwell said, this is a quote from the court records, "Dunn, Yanyar, and Hiller," those are the three draft resisters, "are guilty of no crimes. They merely refuse to become uniformed murderers." For that statement, those two sentences, Caldwell was prosecuted, convicted, and sentenced to 3 years in prison under the Espionage Act. Let's go ahead to World War II. I'll do this one fairly quickly. A lot of people know that there were 6,086 draft refusers in federal prison during the war. There were another 12,000 conscientious objectors who did alternative civilian service in these CPS, civilian public service camps that were run by the historic peace churches for the most part, the Quakers, the Mennonites, the Brethren. There were, in fact, this is much less known, there were, in fact, another 105,000 people who registered as conscientious objectors, but were never recognized as such because they were eligible for other deferments, so they got deferments based on being physically ineligible, being blind in one eye, having a job that led them to an exemption. So there was substantially more, several times more draft opposition, including conscientious objection, during World War II than is commonly accounted for. I'll tell you one mildly amusing story. You know, when these 6,086 pacifist war objectors got to federal prisons, They found quite a bit that was not to their liking, including but not limited to the fact that federal prisons were racially segregated. And they very, very, very quickly started getting into trouble for sitting at the wrong tables. The white draft resistors were sitting at tables with their black draft resistor colleagues and vice versa. You may have heard about the prison strike at Danbury Prison, conducted by over a dozen draft resistors, lasted 135 days and resulted in the desegregation first of Danbury Prison Mess Hall and then the mess halls of the other federal prisons in the United States. It is a sad but true fact that because of the presence of draft resistors in federal prison during the war, federal prisons were desegregated long before the United States Army was. And I'll tell you one amusing anecdote that illustrates how little the prison authorities at Danbury understood what motivated the striking prisoners. So they did a work stoppage, and they refused to eat in a segregated cafeteria. And they were offered the opportunity to eat in the cafeteria when nobody else was there, so it wouldn't be segregated, and they could sit together. And they said, no, 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 that's not good enough. You got to desegregate the whole mess area. So prison barbershops, of course, like the rest of federal prisons, were racially segregated. There were black barbers for black prisoners who would sit in black-only chairs and use only black-only scissors and white-only scissors. And so after the first couple of weeks of the strike, the prison sent to the striking prisoners, who had their own separate section of the prison, there wasn't enough room for them in the hole because there were too many of them, the prison authorities sent two barbers, a black barber for the black strikers and a white barber for the white strikers. And the barbers and the prison authorities were shocked that the strikers refused to have their hair cut by segregated barbers. Go on to the Cold War. And, you know, one of the themes in the book is there's more widely known draft opposition than people commonly account for. And a related theme is that even the historians often get this wrong, as I cited with those Civil War figures in the North. So here's another example of that. The World War II draft ended in 1947. In late 47, early 48, Congress was considering reinstating a draft. This was the time of the Cold War. The communists were going to get us, and we needed to have a peacetime draft. To the draft resistors who had just gotten out of prison, the prospect for opposing conscription in wartime, the prospect of the nation's first peacetime draft was very disturbing, and they organized protests against it called Break with Conscription. On February 12, 1947, while Congress was debating the peacetime draft, hundreds of draft resistors all over the country burned their draft cards, sent them back to the government. I give in the book, I reproduce several of the publicity flyers that they used to promote this event. And historians in general get this wrong. Conventional historians in book after book after book say, the first draft card burning protest was in 1965. And a lot of them cite the photograph of Chris Kearns burning his draft card that appeared in a July 1965 issue of Life magazine. The peace historians like Staunton Lynn, you probably have some of Staunton Lynn's books here. Staunton Lynn really ought to know better. Staunton Lynn, in his book, said, well, yes, he accounts for the break with conscription in February 1947. He says 500 people burned or destroyed their draft cards or sent them back to the government. But they're all wrong. In fact, 1,000 people took part in those demonstrations, committed federal felonies by burning or returning to the government their draft cards, refusing to participate with the draft. They had simultaneous demonstrations that day in big cities like New York, Philadelphia, DC, Los Angeles, but also in a lot of small places. Wichita, Kansas had a demonstration. It was on the front page of their paper. Akron, Ohio, Galesville, Wisconsin. In both New York and Philadelphia, in New York, the demonstration occurred at the Labor Temple on the Lower East Side, and the guys were going to burn their draft cards inside. But the fire marshals came and said they weren't allowed to burn draft cards indoors. So the well-behaved draft resistors who meant to commit federal felonies by not cooperating with Selective Service but did not intend to break the New York Fire Code had the demonstration inside and then went outside to burn their draft cards. Good on them. During the remainder of the Cold War, 1952 to 1960, referrals from Selective Service to the Justice Department for prosecution for violating draft laws averaged 15,000 per annum, of which 6,700 per annum were people who had refused induction. And one of the reasons those figure, and this is the age of madmen and Sloan Wilson's The Man in the Gray Flannel Suit, the conformist, quiet 1950s. And one of the things that makes those figures so startling, 15,000 draft cases a year, is that Selective Service would only refer a matter to the Justice Department for prosecution after the FBI had been unsuccessful in going to the resistor and remonstrating and trying to get them to cooperate and trying to talk them into it and trying all sorts of legal ways. So this is the end of a very long and unsuccessful process for the government. During this period, the National Council Against Conscription had small grassroots local chapters in 82 cities in the United States. And again, some of those were big, big groups, you know, with fancy letterhead in big cities, but others were just little groups in little towns dotted all over the Midwest and Pacific Northwest. And my view is that any time you have 82 small and large grassroots organizations all over the country coordinating work toward a particular goal, in this case against conscription, that betokens a strong movement. I'm going to say just briefly one aspect of sort of opposition to the draft that occurred during the Vietnam War that I'm hoping some of you aren't familiar with. So you may know that on Saturday, October 21st, 1967, there was a large legal anti-war demonstration in Washington, D.C. called Confront the War Makers. And that night, Saturday night, the 21st to Sunday morning, the 22nd of October, about 50,000 people camped out around the Pentagon. About 50 or 52 people burned draft cards that night. President Johnson was outraged, and he called the director of Selective Service, General Louis B. Hershey, and said, something needs to be done about this. Something needs to be done about this. And General Hershey sent out both a memorandum and a letter to every draft board in the country. There were 4,101 of them that said that people who protested against the war, protested against the draft, should be reclassified from whatever deferment they had. They should be immediately reclassified to 1A, immediately eligible to be drafted. They lose their deferment, they get drafted immediately. And they should be moved to the front of the line in the order of call, because there was a fairly complicated order of call for people who were classified 1A. Hershey had done that once before in 1965 after there had been a sit-in at the draft boards in Ann Arbor, Michigan, and he had reclassified about 22 demonstrators 1A. They had taken it to court. The courts threw it out immediately. The courts uniformly said that's illegal. You cannot reclassify people 1A because they attend a legal protest or an illegal protest. You just can't do that. But in this case, Hershey did that, and what had been sort of a one-off before, 1965, now became official policy. The Attorney General of the United States, Ramsey Clark, thought that there were legal questions about that, that you might not be able to do that. And there was a public spat between Attorney General Ramsey Clark and General Louis B. Hershey about Hershey's order. Hershey's order became public when the New York Times published both the letter and the memorandum to draft boards in the issue of November 9th, 1967. And there was a back and forth in the mainstream media and the press between Clark and Hershey about the legality of the Hershey order. Something had to be done because this was looking very, very bad for the government. Here was the head of Selective Service ordering that something be done and the Attorney General saying it was illegal. So the White House sent a White House aide, Joe Califano. He was later Secretary of Health, Education, and Welfare when that was a department, to mediate the spat between Hershey and Clark. And in December, they published a memorandum, a joint memorandum signed by both Hershey and Clark that sort of smoothed over the differences and said, we'll be vigorous about prosecuting things, and sort of evaded the issue. And the press went away and said, okay, everything's resolved. And the historians who've written about it, what is his name, Flynn, George Q. Flynn, and Michael Foley, who's a peace movement historian, all say, yeah, the dispute went away. It was smoothed over by Joe Califano. And that is absolutely not true. What those historians didn't do was they didn't look at the transcript of the argument in the U.S. Supreme Court or the briefs that the government filed in the U.S. Supreme Court in the cases that followed that. So the first guy who got prosecuted under the new Hershey order was a young divinity student from Idaho, Jim Osterreich. And he lost his divinity deferment. He was reclassified 1A. He was drafted. He refused induction. He was prosecuted. The ACLU took his case to the U.S. Supreme Court. Melvin Wolf of the ACLU represented this young divinity student, Jim Osterreich. The federal government and Selective Service were represented by the Solicitor General of the United States, whose job it is to represent the government position in U.S. Supreme Court cases. It was Irwin Griswold. The longtime dean of Harvard Law School was now the Solicitor General for Presidents Kennedy and Johnson. And Irwin Griswold, the Solicitor General, representing the United States of America, told the Supreme Court in the Osterreich case three things. One, Hershey's letter invited illegal activity by draft boards. Two, there was absolutely no authority in the law for reclassifying dissenters 1A. And three, had there been such a provision in the law, which there was not, it would have been unconstitutional. The ACLU's case was presented to the Supreme Court by the Solicitor General, both in the briefs and in the oral argument, and those are the things that were missed by all the historians who have written about it. To give you an idea how startling that is, you know, February of 2011, when the Obama administration announced publicly that it wasn't going to defend the Defense of Marriage Act that outlawed gay marriage, That was on the front page of every newspaper in the country because that was a huge deal. The statutory job of the Solicitor General of the United States is to defend the U.S. government position in the Supreme Court. And here was Obama refusing to do it. Here was Irwin Griswold doing just the same sort of thing. And what was really a bit shocking about the case was that Hershey's action, General Hershey's action, reclassifying dissenters and protesters 1A, was declared illegal back in 1965 by every court that considered it. Then, in 1967, after the demonstrations at the Pentagon, and Jim Oesterreich took the case to the Supreme Court, it was declared unconstitutional again, but the government kept doing it. And the ACLU had to bring an identical case to the U.S. Supreme Court a year later called Breen. And in that case, the Supreme Court ruled the same way and was fairly peeved with Selective Service. They said, we don't see the difference between this case and the other case. In other words, the justices were saying, you know, we meant it the last time, guys. So I will end there. That is a quick romp through the new book. The themes are, there's a big untold history here. There's a lot of stuff that hasn't been dug up. And the historians, the so-called scholars in the field, often get it wrong. I will be open to questions, comments, disagreements. Both of my books are available here tonight. The earlier one, Felon for Peace, the memoir of a Vietnam-era draft resister, is sensibly priced and talks a lot about the Vietnam-era stuff and draft resistance and the draft board raids. This history was published by an academic publisher, Brill, is not sensibly priced. Don't feel obligated to buy it. Burning Books will make a tidy profit on it, but don't blame either Burning Books or me for the price of the second book. So I said I destroyed files at 14 draft boards in three cities. In November of 1969, I was part of a group that burglarized six draft boards at four separate locations in Boston simultaneously. We destroyed all of the 1A files, the files of men eligible to be drafted, the duplicate records at the local boards, and also the separate files of the newly registered men. The next action was in Providence, Rhode Island, the weekend of June 12th to 14th, 1970. You remember that June 12th, 1970 was a Friday, right? You recall that. Everybody knows that. We burglarized the Rhode Island, well, it was the Providence, Rhode Island Selective Service Complex. It housed four local draft boards and the state headquarters. Once again, well, we went in on Friday night. We worked all night. We shredded files there. We carried away the cross-reference system, the duplicate records, because those were too voluminous to destroy there. We held a press conference in downtown Providence a week later on Friday, June 19th, to describe what we had done and why we had done it. The press conference was very, very well attended. Every FBI agent in Providence was there. Every Providence city detective was there. The United States attorney was there. And the press was there. And the third set of draft boards, four draft boards in Rochester, New York, the Labor Day weekend of 1970, unlike the other cases in the Boston case, people who were responsible for that surfaced publicly a week later at a large demonstration in Washington by handing out stolen draft files to the press and to FBI agents. Rochester was a little bit different in that some of the people involved in that actually were arrested at the end. People went in at night, at dusk, spent overnight working, were getting ready to leave the next morning, and were intercepted by police. So they didn't get a chance to surface publicly later. They were arrested at the scene of the crime. I had been a draft resister. I turned 18 on August 30th, 1969. It was the height of the war. I'll save you the arithmetic calculation. That makes me 72. And, you know, the law required men to register on or within 5 days of their 18th birthday. I was opposed to the draft. I was opposed to the war. I didn't want to take advantage of a special privilege, student deferment, conscientious objector classification. I didn't want to be any part of it. So I went to my draft board on my birthday, actually the first business day after my birthday. My birthday fell on the weekend that year. I gave a very lengthy statement to Mrs. Abraham, the clerk, explaining why I wasn't going to register. I took the 5 days that they gave me to register to fast and give out leaflets at the draft board urging others not to cooperate. But, I mean, the reason I took part in those episodes of draft file destruction was I didn't think that merely refusing to be a part of the draft myself was an active enough way to oppose conscription. I wanted to do something that was more active, and the best thing I could think of was burglarizing draft boards, holding press conferences afterward to explain what we had done so that in that way it was public, people could connect us with what we were doing. I said earlier that I thought these actions were effective, and in fact they were. Those four local draft boards in Providence that we raided on June 13, 1970, never drafted again in the war. In all cases, what happened when people destroyed draft files like that, 44 boards in Indianapolis, 34 boards on the south side of Chicago, dozens of boards in New York and Philadelphia and Minneapolis, St. Paul, all over the country. What happened was the draft boards that had their files destroyed tried to redistribute their quotas to other draft boards in the state. The problem with that was that the other draft boards in the state were usually not making their own draft quotas because people were going to Canada, people were going underground, people were forgetting to register, people were faking bone spurs in their feet. So draft boards were not meeting their own quotas, and when we destroyed files at some boards, they tried to redistribute the quotas, they couldn't do it. And the result was some people over here were not drafted, and other people over here, they tried, but they failed to draft them in their place. So that was the net result. And one of the reasons these actions proved effective is that hundreds of course, if you do 44 boards in one night, as happened in Indianapolis, or 34 boards in one night in Chicago, it's easy to rack up the numbers and get hundreds of draft boards that had their files destroyed.
Was that your group doing?
No. I only did six boards in Boston, four in Providence, four in Rochester. These were all different groups, and for the most part, they were separate, independent creations. I mean, we helped each other. Two of my friends, Susie Williams and DeCourcy Squire, who were planning to do the Rochester boards, came and helped us. You know what they say in a hospital with surgeons and surgery operations. See one, do one, teach one. And that's essentially what we did. I mean, when I did the Boston draft boards, I had graduated from high school a few weeks before. I was a not terribly experienced 18-year-old kid. I certainly, a middle-class suburban kid, I certainly had no skills as a burglar, but I learned. I was a good learner. And so I saw one in Boston, took part in it. I organized the one in Providence. Susie and DeCourcy came from Rochester to help us, but then they organized the one in Rochester. These were all different groups, which partly accounted for the difficulty that the federal authorities had in infiltrating them, that there was no central organizing authority setting everything up. There were people in different places, and to be sure, people in earlier actions helped out the people in the later actions. It was a very cooperative venture. As with any semi-clandestine action, there is a fairly elaborate dance where you approach people and you start by speaking obliquely and then you hear what they say and you get less and less oblique and you start with people you know. I ended up doing the burglary in Providence with my high school friend, Bug, whom Leslie was talking about. Well, I had known him for years and years and years. We'd organized anti-war demonstrations together over a period of time. It wasn't a shot out of the blue. So what's interesting is that in parallel to what you just described very well here in Buffalo, there were literally thousands of draft counselors like that at hundreds of draft counseling centers all over the country. And if you think about it, that's a lot of people. And it one of the reasons why the draft ultimately did not work during the Vietnam War was because of people like you and draft counselors like you all over the country. I can give you a few examples from my new book. So, for example, Selective Service Regulations said that any time a registrant provides his draft board with any new information, they have to reopen his case. So you apply for conscientious objector status, you're turned down. The draft counselor tells you your appeal procedure within Selective Service and to a Presidential Board of Appeal takes 18 months. You get turned down. At the end of 18 months, you send them a new letter from your minister saying that you're against war, and they have to reopen your case. They turn you down again, but you appeal again, and you appeal again, and it's another 18 months. Then it goes back to your draft board, and you send in another. That's what draft counselors did. They knew the rules, they knew the regulations, and they could tell young men what they needed to do. Another example was when Nixon put in the lottery in 1969, the big idea of the lottery, we're going to make the draft fair. And instead of exposing men to be drafted for 8 years from age 18 to age 26, we would compress your period of vulnerability to only 1 year. And then men could plan their lives better, and it would be fairer, and it would be better. And it completely failed. And I actually quote in the book the memorandum from the head of Selective Service at the time, Curtis Tarr, to President Nixon, explaining why it didn't work. And it didn't work because of you, sir. The problem was, in the first year of the lottery, it became clear that they weren't going to go above number 195. That everybody got a random number based on their birth date, from 1 to 366, for 366 different possible birth dates. And we are going to draw numbers randomly, and that way the draft will be fair. The first year, it became apparent that they weren't going to go above 195. So 10,000 draft counselors like you at hundreds of centers all over the country immediately told all the students to give up their deferments, because by theoretically exposing themselves to the draft at a time when they never could be drafted, they would be free for life. And stuff like that went on all the time. And that's why when guys like me destroyed files at draft boards and they tried to redistribute their quotas to other places, guys like you made sure that those other draft boards couldn't make up those quotas. In 1948, when the first peacetime draft was being considered in Congress, there was created an entity, a group called the Central Committee for Conscientious Objectors, CCCO, based in Philadelphia. And this was a full-time, paid, salaried staff that included lawyers who, and I will acknowledge, I'm a lawyer, that selective service law is a very, very arcane and obscure branch of law. And most lawyers knew nothing about select, and fair enough, it was an obscure and arcane branch of law. But they kept up with the statutes, the changes in the statutes, all the regulations, what the regulations meant, and there was no internet. But they produced that stuff on mimeograph sheets. They sent it out to all the draft counselors. And the result of that was that local draft counselors in little eensy-weensy towns in Podunk, Iowa, and Peoria, Illinois, had really accurate, up-to-date information and were able to pass that along to young men. And it was, as you observed, it was very, very effective for that reason. There was a central coordinating body that provided that information to everybody. So I retired from the practice of law on June 5th, 2020. It was not because of COVID. I had planned to retire for 8 months before. The last 13 and a half years, I had been working for an environmental nonprofit, mostly on matters pertaining to climate change. I had sort of a very, very narrow subspecialty in the wholesale interstate FERC-regulated energy markets, because energy has a big contribution to climate change, and we were working on that. So before I retired, my wife sat me down, this is true, and she said to me, when you retire, you better have something to do that'll keep you busy, because otherwise there's going to be trouble around here. And so I had been interested in this subject of conscription, as you can see, for decades. Nobody had ever written a book about the history of conscription. So I spent 3 years from June 2020 to spring of 2023 researching the book in archives, doing the reading, doing the research, writing the book, going through peer review, going through copy editing, finding a publisher, all of that. Once this book was out, I turned my, this is why you're going to be disappointed, I turned my attention to another subject that had interested me for a long time, and now I'm doing research on some genealogical history, the history and history of Jews in Central and Eastern Europe in the 17th, 18th, and 19th centuries, and I'm trying to situate my family and my ancestors in the picture of sort of the wider things that were happening in European history at that time. And I will say, I will not bore you with tales of Central European Jews in the mid-18th century, but I will say that, like with this previous book, I am finding a fair amount of stuff that really surprises me. I am finding death certificates for whole branches of family members who died in the Holocaust, who died in concentration camps of Theresienstadt and Auschwitz and elsewhere. I'm finding branches of the family who were famous rabbis in Hungary and in Moravia. My great-great-great-great-grandfather's picture is hanging in the Jewish Museum in Prague because he was the chief rabbi of Moravia in the 1780s. So that is what I've been doing since the draft book was published. So what on earth is the criterion that makes someone jump from that topic to this? It's very simple. I can tell you in one sentence. It's just stuff that interests me. That's. And so I've been engaged in this, and my wife is mollified. I've been behaving well because I have a project that engages me. I'll say two things about that. First, there was a disproportionately large number of Catholic priests, nuns, and ex-priests and nuns involved in the draft board raids. So, for example, the Catonsville 9 action, which was local board 33 in Catonsville, Maryland, was primarily priests, nuns, one Christian brother, David Darst, some ex-priests, ex-nuns, and their public statement was 15 paragraphs long. Five of the 15 paragraphs were quotations of a papal encyclical. Now, think about radical protesters today breaking the law, burglarizing federal office building, and in their public statement to explain it, they quote a papal encyclical on peace. It's hard to imagine. So, on the one hand, yes, there was a disproportionately large representation of Catholic priests, nuns, and ex-priests and nuns. On the other hand, that public perception is significantly, in fact, almost vastly overstated. So the Providence draft board action that I was in were two Jewish suburban kids from New York, and we ended up doing Providence because we wanted to do a state headquarters, and we cased five of them in Boston, Albany, Hartford, I think it was Trenton, and Providence. We settled on Providence. Even the first draft board action that Phil Berrigan was in before Catonsville, the Baltimore blood pouring on October 27th, 1967, right after the siege of the Pentagon, there were four people involved in that, and two of them were not even Catholic. Jim Mengel was a United Church of Christ minister, and Dave Eberhardt was a self-described Episcopalian who had grown up in a Presbyterian household. So, you know, the Rochester action was a bunch of Quakers, and the folks who did the Lansdowne, Pennsylvania draft boards were a bunch of 19 and 20-year-old hippies with no discernible religious affiliation that I could ever figure out. So on the one hand, yes, there were a lot of priests and nuns involved in it. On the other hand, that public perception is very, very overstated, and there were lots of folks who were not quoting papal encyclicals in their public statements. On the first half of your question, I don't know what the odds are of the draft coming back. My immediate thought, which is not based on any rigid research or polling or anything like, or knowledge of what's perking in Congress, is that the chances are fairly small. And I say that for two different reasons. One is, I think the government has figured out correctly, I believe, that fighting foreign wars is easier to do when you're not conscripting people against their will, because that tends to create and stimulate opposition. The second reason that I think, and that's based on the current research that I did, is that there is a very, very strong and deep sentiment historically in the United States against standing armies and against conscription. The first chapter in the book, I talk about how, everybody knows that there were states after the Constitutional Convention in Philadelphia in 1787 that didn't want to ratify the Constitution without a Bill of Rights. But there were also states that refused to ratify or were reluctant to ratify the Constitution because it didn't have provisions banning a standing army. And the Constitution, the pre-Revolutionary War constitutions of many states and the post-Revolutionary Wars of many states had anti-draft provisions in them, provisions for conscientious objectors, and provisions against standing armies. And there is a long and deep history of anti-conscription sentiment in the United States, so I think it is unlikely to come back. Would it be harder to oppose it? Again, I don't know for sure. I haven't really looked into it too deeply, but I suspect that the answer is yes. For example, when we went into the Providence Draft Board complex on Saturday night, June 13th, 1970, we were able to destroy all of the 1A files, the men eligible to be drafted, all three critical portions of the cross-reference system, all the duplicate records in the state headquarters in one night, if you count the records we carried away in trucks to burn later that week. There were no electronic records, no electronic files, no data bank. Everything was on paper. Everything was on paper. There were no motion sensors in the building. There were no burglar alarms. Now, some buildings had burglar alarms, but back in the days when I was a professional burglar, things were really different because burglar alarms were less sophisticated. Motion sensors hadn't been invented. Electronic duplicate records off-site didn't exist. So I haven't looked into it, but I have to believe that it would be more difficult now than it was 54 years ago. I can barely use email. Technology has changed since the old days when I was a burglar. When I wrote my first book, I've always been something of a pack rat, and I had a lot of the documents from these things. I went back to refresh my recollection. And one of the things that interested me and surprised me was how, in some cases, my recollections 35 years after the event jibe really accurately with what the written record said, what I saw in the leaflets, what I saw in the newspapers, what I saw in the magazines, and how accurate my mental recollections were, and in other cases, how inaccurate they were. How I thought something had happened in October of 68, and it was October of 67. I just had the chronology all bollocked up. And friends of mine who are psychiatrists explained to me that, yes, this happens, and our memories can play tricks on us, and they're accurate in some respects and not accurate in others. And I was very, very grateful to have the written record. I did talk to some people. I mean, a lot of the people, well, of course, everybody who appears in the first book as a memoir are my colleagues and friends and people I knew. In the second book, I enjoyed, I must say it was fun, finding in archives records of people that I knew. And here's what they did during the prison strike at Danbury, Connecticut to desegregate the prison, and my friends at Ashland, Kentucky, you know, striking to desegregate that prison, and the ones at Lewisburg doing it there, and these were people I knew, and I got file pictures of them, and I thought, geez, this guy, he's wearing a tie? I never saw him in a tie. How did that happen? It was interesting going back and talking to people, and it definitely informed what I wrote. I didn't address that. The answer is, in part, there is no conscription in the United States. People are not being drafted involuntarily. The Selective Service system does exist, and the legal obligation for men only to register on their 18th birthday or within 5 days thereafter continues. There continues to be some opposition to it. It is very, very much attenuated from what it was during the Vietnam War because nobody's being drafted and nobody's being drafted into a war situation. So, yes, there is a selective service system. It is vastly smaller than it was. They don't do much classifying of people. All they do is accept registration papers from people so that in the event that we return to conscription, you don't have to do what you did in September 1917 when you institute a draft and you suddenly have to get tens of millions of people to register, to even know who is there. And you don't have to do what you did in October, early October 1940 with the World War II draft, suddenly get tens of millions of men to register. The idea is that that's all taken care of. What you have now is, I don't know what the percentages are, I haven't looked into it, but there is a, I think, a fairly substantial percentage of men who are supposed to register who really don't know about it and don't, and another chunk of people who know jolly well about it and forget. There are a number of corollary laws in place that encourage men to register, federally supported student loans you can't get unless you sign an affidavit that says you've registered, and so forth. So yes, there is selective service. No, there's no conscription. Draft went out of business. There was the draft ended in July of 1973 when candidate Richard Nixon was running for office in 1968. In October 1968, he announced that he wanted to end conscription. He meant that. My view is it was not because of his Quaker grandmother. It was because of this guy here and all these people who are opposing the draft. And he did end the draft in July of 1973. So thank you very much. Support Burning Books. They have not just my books, but lots of books that are good. Yes, so do support Burning Books, and thank you for joining us this evening.